Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Mark Zorns. Mark is co-founder and CEO of Winno, the startup that's developed technology to help chefs achieve greater visibility in their kitchens and make better decisions that lead to dramatically reduced food waste and costs. Mark and his team are on a mission to connect the commercial kitchen, create a movement of chefs, and inspire others to see that food is too valuable to waste. Before founding Winno in 2013, Mark worked as a strategy consultant at McKinsey, where he was a co-author of the internationally renowned Resource Revolution Report, which identified multi-trillion dollars worth of opportunities from resource productivity and circular economy. I spoke to Mark online from his office in London. So Mark, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thanks, Tony.
I'm really excited about this interview. We first met, I think it must be going about 4 or 5 years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I actually remember both meeting over a coffee and sort of talking about what we were doing as we were getting going. And then actually, one of my stronger memories is coming out to meet you while you were teaching and presenting some of the early progress we were making to a course on innovation and sustainability.
That's right. So that was the One Planet MBA cohort at Exeter. And a really engaged group, and I think gave you some quite challenging questions and perspectives on why you were doing things a certain way. So I mean, so much has changed in that time. I've watched your progress with great interest. I'm looking forward to getting into talking about kind of where you're at with the business, where it's heading, what you see coming over the hill, and you know, longer term vision stuff. But I think for listeners, I'd be really interested in understanding, first of all, kind of, you know, how you got started and all this. Why does this matter so much to you?
Yeah, so, you know, at Winno, what we really believe is that food is too valuable to be wasted. And we believe that technology can be used to transform the way that we make food, and that we want to create a movement of chefs, really, to create a broader social change around addressing this problem. You know, food for me has always been a very central part of my life. My family, growing up, cooked a lot. I have always had a love and a respect for food and sort of what it brings. You know, my first job out of university was working for a company called C&S Wholesale Grocers, and it was a food distribution company that pretty much did the back-end supply chain for retailers across the United States. And I grew them in a very, very fast time of growth. And it gave me an interesting perspective on the food supply chain, because I was kind of sitting smack dab in the middle of it, looking upstream at sort of large manufacturers like P&G and Heinz and others, and then downstream into the retail world to really understand kind of the and respect what it takes to be able to feed a population day in and day out. And I continued that interest in food when I later on ended up at McKinsey, where I worked in their consumer practice and spent a lot of time working on strategy projects, private equity due diligences, operational projects related to, you know, consumer packaged goods companies, so fast-moving consumer goods organizations, to retailers and the like. And I guess, you know, if you put that in parallel with, for me, a passion for wanting to address the fact that we're living an unsustainable lifestyle on this planet. And this is something that, you know, I firmly believe that our generation and the generation before me and immediately after really hold the weight of the responsibility to address, that we've got to do something about it. And I reflect that where I can contribute to this is, you know, I really understand how a business works. I understand how the food supply chain works. And if I can find a model that addresses a major environmental issue, but does so in a way that business is going to adopt it because it drives lower costs and improved profitability, then I have a solution that I know how to scale up to be able to make change. I'm not a politician. I think policy is a very important role in this, but it's just not my forte. If I can use the avenue of technology and business to drive change at scale, then that's really where my heart is to be able to push forward. And so this issue of food waste came up when I was working for McKinsey, working in the McKinsey Global Institute and looking at the big areas of resource productivity. And food waste is a $1 trillion problem. And, you know, just a few years ago, we didn't even understand the scale of this issue. It was one of the biggest issues in the world, and hardly anyone was doing anything about it.
I was going to say, I mean, you don't have to go that far back, do you, for that to be the case? I mean, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago, maybe seven. Awareness was so limited, even within the food industry.
That's right. And I think what you see now is many organizations cropping up to address this issue. And I think that is both exciting and required. You know, back when we started Winnow, there were just a handful of companies looking to solve the issue of food waste. And now you can go onto the ReFed website and find thousands of companies that are actually doing something about it. And so it's a real broader social change that we're seeing happen.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's interesting for me is that you know, probably reflective of the wider movement around sustainability and addressing environmental problems, has been that the narrative has shifted. You know, we've gone from having years of trying to articulate the problem to a shift of narrative now to more of an opportunity framing. And I think the Resource Revolution report that came out from McKinsey back in, was it 2012? You know, it was a key sort of seminal moment in that, in terms of putting it into business language, quantifying the scale of the opportunity for business to respond to exploit.
That's right. And you know, where I think a lot of work still needs to be done, but you know, it's not just been the work that we've done through the McKinsey Global Institute. For example, the work done by the New Climate Economy has really begun to lay out that a lot of the things that need to be done to address the climate challenge that we have and that we're going to be facing is really something that will be job creating, will create value for business, will create value for society, and is a win-win. So kind of how do we get on with it is the real question.
It was around that sort of time when there was a nascent social investment market as well. And there was, I guess, the business community and the investor community were struggling to see how you could solve an environmental or social problem, be a mission-driven business in a way that didn't compromise on profitability. You know, there was some concession made, you know, trade-off between the two. And yet you've resolutely, I remember, you know, from early conversations around the time you were just setting Winnow up, resolutely sort of determined to create Winnow more in the kind of for-profit mold, but solving a problem, you know, very mission-driven, but, you know, attractive to investors on equal footing to any other business.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. I mean, we've always had businesses that have gone out to solve big societal problems. I think what's a little bit different today is you've got a number of young organizations that are really putting that social mission at the heart and in how they communicate it from a branding perspective and how they communicate it from a investment thesis perspective as well. You know, when we first started at Winnow, we were, you know, looking for angel investments. And, you know, we were able to find that relatively easy through the networks that we had. We were very fortunate to have a number of people that believed in us. And we were able to fund the business ourselves for over 12 months out of our own pocket to be able to show that there really was a commercial business here. But it was really, you know, a group called Mustard Seed, which is an investment fund that I think is fantastic. They invest in businesses that have what they call a lockstep business model, which means that they make money by solving a social problem. And what's really exciting about that is when you have that model, there's a couple of things that just get easier and more embedded into the business than you would have if the social mission was, say, something on the side or something that was an aspiration. Mm-hmm. One is everything you're doing to grow your business is pushing forward the addressing that social issue. So for the example of Winnow, any marketing efforts we have, any communication we have to the market to celebrate companies that are making change or to reach out to organizations about how they should make change is very much in line with driving forward the issue of addressing food waste. It's also fully aligned with growing our business. And so we don't really have to make, you know, those types of trade-offs. And our investors can have confidence that when they put money in Winnow, that if it's run well, it's a business that should have good returns, but it's also a business that by design, they're able to back an organization that is solving a problem that they also believe should be addressed. And I think there's something really tight within that. Mustard Seed has since grown to make a very solid number of investments and know that they continue to look to scale that. And what we see is that even at the top end, larger private equity funds looking to create funds that invest in business that have gone past the initial scaling phase to the growth phase to scale up similar opportunities. I still think there's a long way to go in creating enough available capital to help social impact businesses scale. But it's certainly starting to move in the right direction.
I mean, to some extent, it's a chicken and egg, right? In terms of, you know, if you've got a strong deal flow, it will bring investors in. And the lack of investment funds available kind of puts off people from thinking that they can raise funds to do what they want to do. So, you know, you kind of need to break that cycle somehow. But you inch forward, I guess, and cases like your business, you know, help to embolden people and give them confidence that actually this is doable. And, you know, on both sides, both on the investee and the investor side, I guess.
Absolutely.
Going back to the genesis of Winnow, to what extent did you have entrepreneurial intentions when you were at McKinsey? You know, is this something you always wanted to do? It was just a case of just trying to find the right opportunity?
Yeah, look, for me, this was always something that I wanted to do. I've always wanted to build a business. So I've actually run a business in the past while I was at university and, you know, was part of a founding of another business called Sapphira, which focused on, you know, developing software for architects to design buildings in a more energy efficient way. So, you know, my father was an entrepreneur. You know, my grandfather ran his own business. And building a business has always been something that I knew that I was going to do and has been something at the heart of what I want to build. For me, what it was there's just this moment where you realize that there's this enormous opportunity out there and that there is just a white space that you can run out and grab. And it also happens to be something that you have spent your entire life trying to understand. And I don't think those moments really come up very often. You know, when that moment presents itself, it pretty much compelled me to act, which was why I left McKinsey to found Winnow.
How important at that time was finding the co-founders? I mean, were these people that you already worked with, that you had in your network, or was it a case of, you know, you got a straw man of what you think the solution might be, but you need to identify the right people to help you build it?
Co-founders are immensely important. Building a business with someone means you're going to spend, the business works, 5 to 10 years, day in and day out with someone in the trenches through good times and bad. And it's important that it's someone that you trust. It's important that it's someone that you can be honest with. And it's important that it's someone that you can have a disagreement with, see through that disagreement, and move forward together. You know, it's often likened to a marriage in sort of many ways. I was very fortunate to have Kevin Duffy, who I knew very well from school, who I had actually lived with, who I convinced to come and join me on that journey, and who also would help to invest his own capital in bringing the additional skill sets needed around to build that business. So, you know, finding a co-founder is critical. I think finding a co-founder is more important than finding the idea, if I were to rank things, because your approach to the solution will change over time. If it doesn't, then you're probably not thinking hard enough about how you should move things forward. Yeah. And I've been really thankful.
An early stage investors would see it the same way, wouldn't they? I mean, you hear time and again people saying we invest in the team.
Yeah, I think it's important to have three things. I think it's important to have a founding team with the skills that will be needed to be successful. I think it's equally important to have a good dynamic between that team, that they will be able to work together through thick and thin. And then finally, I think it's important that that team is focused on an opportunity that's big enough and interesting enough to really put a lot of capital behind to find the solution. And it's those three pieces, I think, that are critical for success. I think it's probably less critical what the solution looks like day one. If you believe that the team is going to be open-minded enough and thoughtful enough about how they search out for what that right solution should be, every organization evolves. And if you're investing in a very early stage business that doesn't yet have revenue, you should have the expectation that that's going to significantly change as things move forward.
And then having built a functional prototype and going out and testing in the market, the hardest thing a lot of people complain about in a startup environment is the cost of customer acquisition, particularly the first customer. So how critical was that? I know Compass Group played a huge role in the very early days in terms of helping to test and validate your proof of concept, provide confidence to the wider market as a big player that this was a credible solution.
Yeah. I think finding that first customer is always a challenge because nobody believes you've got a solution until someone's willing to take that risk. And especially if you're trying to deal with large organizations, that risk appetite in many parts of these organizations and with many organizations is relatively low compared to what is needed to really drive innovation. I think, the way we found that was we found a pocket of an organization that was willing to take that risk. We invested heavily in hearing their feedback and refining our product and then carrying it forward. And Compass continues to be a big customer of ours. What's important as well is to then take that and then branch out to other parts of the market and really understand based on what you've built, what works with other organizations, what are the other demands that are needed, and really build up a solution that can scale. But that first customer and how you not only convince them to try your product, but to pay for your product and to pay for your solution is a challenge and something that takes time. I mean, one advice that I would have for anyone starting a business to business company, and for us, I wouldn't even say we're business to business, we're business to enterprise, is be really clear on the value proposition you're building and look back at first principles in terms of what you are delivering. Sometimes that's incredibly positive. Sometimes that may not be. What unfortunately you don't get in a business to enterprise environment is lots of feedback on is this product working or not? Because the decisions that these large organizations make are big decisions in one direction or another. And they can be driven by people changing in a role. They can be driven by the priorities of that organization within a given year. And what you often get in a business enterprise business as you're scaling it up is very few signals around is this right or not. And so you have to be very confident that you have something that is delivering value, very thoughtful around how you build the early days while you wait for those large decisions to come through. Once you get to a point where we are, and you're having a large number of discussions with a whole bunch of companies, you get more of that feedback and it becomes a bit more apparent around the direction you should go. But those early days, I would say, were particularly hard when, the validation, even though it was coming in positively, came in very, very infrequently, which as an entrepreneur is not only challenging to deal with financially, but also emotionally as an entrepreneur, which is something that's often overlooked.
Absolutely. Part of your addressing of that, seems to me, was around building a really strong team of advisors who knew the food service industry inside out at a very senior level. Were they really critical in terms of, A, the emotional side, in terms of, holding your faith that there's a market out there for this in the absence of feedback from customers? And secondly, in terms of, giving you insight around how you shape that value proposition?
I think that was important. To be honest, Tony, I don't know if I would go as far as saying that it was as critical as you're making it out to be, and I in no way want to minimize the fantastic input that we got from a number of individuals that spent their time trying to help us understand how we should build our business. From an advice perspective, and from a you know, sort of an external validation from any sort of advisory network from us that really add value is three things. One is, you're right, there was something around understanding the market. And it was critical and helped us get to speed very, very quickly in terms of what are the drivers of this business. What I think was equally important were people that had built young organizations that sold into large organizations and what that looked like. There's a term called a decision-making unit that when you need to sell into a big company, there's a whole bunch of people you have to get involved, and how you find who those people are and how you map them out and make sure that you've got that large organization bought into what you're doing. There's no one person that will make a buying decision. Being able to frame that and understand, that's really key. And it was the Seedcamp partners that first pointed us in that direction, which I think was really helpful. We had many other advisors, another guy named Matt Webb, who's an amazing individual when it comes to the hardware startup space in the UK, that gave us advice on how we do our engineering and design our product. The sort of third area of advice was just on fundraising and capital. And I think we were very fortunate, again, to just go back to the Mustard Seed team, to have them as a great shoulder to lean on as we thought about the capital needed to scale this business. It's also something that I would point that my co-founder excels at, and is something that I'm very thankful to have him for.
Going back to you were saying about the emotional strain and frustrations of the early stage of startup. Now, can you just give us a sense of, in the first 12 months, where were you getting the most stuck and what did you find the most difficult to deal with personally?
So, you know, Tony, this is something that's really sort of close to my heart, right? It should not be underestimated how difficult often the emotional journey that a founder goes through. One goes from being well-respected in an organization and being able to point partly to your own value professionally tied into the value that organization has, and the reputation that has. I was, you know, from a very strong firm. I could walk into board meeting rooms and provide advice. People valued that, and I thought that part came from me, but honestly, I think also that came from the organization sitting behind me within McKinsey. You then step away from that, and all you've got is you and your co-founder, and you're facing the cold wind of the market in terms of, you know, what they're going to need and what's required. You know, no one owes you any favors in that environment. And all of your professional being is inside this nascent idea that you don't know if you're going to succeed or fail. And there are many moments along the way where you're looking failure square in the eyes and asking, is this how it's going to end up? So, you know, as a founder, the emotional journey that you go through is one of some big swings up and down, and it's something that's sort of very dear to my heart because it's something that I didn't anticipate when I founded Winnow, and something that I really, you know, lived completely. You go from being in a stable organization, doing well in that organization, to leaving all of that and putting your entire professional being into a nascent idea that will either work or not. And odds are it's not going to work, because that's kind of the statistics of a startups, right? And so you go from some moments looking failure square in the eyes and feeling like this is never going to work. And I can tell you that I've had enough of those myself, to at other moments having a success and feeling like it's going to be weeks before you conquer the world. And I've had my fair amount of those. And you know, neither of those is reality. But the emotional swings that a founder goes through, I've never felt anything stronger with that in my professional career. And it's something that is challenging to manage. But you know, the way that I sort of pressed through that was I had a passion and a belief for the problem I was trying to solve. And You know, the reason that I got into this was I knew that if I didn't try to take a stab at solving this issue, that I was going to regret it. And even if I had failed, I don't think it would have been at a loss. And now that we're starting to succeed, I'm incredibly excited about where this can go from here. And, you know, I think that's really what the payoff is. And so when you're building a business, whether you're doing it now or whether you're thinking about doing it, you know, my only thing to say is just to take solace in the fact that everyone's going to have big ups and downs early days. Be prepared for that. And know that when you make it through on the other side, it's very positive. But also know that there's a cohort of other people around you that are going through the same thing. And often just reaching out to have a conversation with people about that is something that can be a massive help.
Because you've been through startup incubator cohorts, like Seedcamp you mentioned. You know, they're one way of building that community around you, people that in the same shoes, and you can walk alongside each other and are there for support. So I can see how that could be incredibly helpful. But also, I mean, there's the family behind mm-hmm. you as well. You know, where have you had to lean, and to what extent has it been an important factor in you dealing with all these highs and lows to know you've got the support behind you?
On all of those communities, my wife has been immensely supportive, and I am so grateful for what she has provided, not just in terms of financial stability at times, but emotional support when the times were very, very challenging. I had moments where I was at a near breaking point where I talked to her and she helped me get through it. And I really appreciate that. I've had other parts of my family that I've spoken to about similar things, and then founders that are sort of going through it all. I mean, you know, those support structures are important for anyone to sort of have around them. And you know, I guess I'm grateful enough to have a number of those around me. But ultimately, at the same time, you've got to make that decision for yourself. And what one needs to do is be able to lean on others when you're at a moment where you need that help, but at the same time, come back to center and say, why am I doing this? Yeah. From first principles, where is this going? And therefore, what's the path ahead? And that's been, you know, I wouldn't call it my true north, because I wouldn't be as conceited to say that that's really kind of the main source for it. But it's something that I have really had to do a number of times to make sure that we're headed in the right direction for the organization.
But with the odds stacked against you, particularly those early days, you know, being open and honest with your partner in life about, you know, the likelihood or possibility of things going wrong, you know, and there being great personal cost, both financial and emotional, from that. You know, it's incredibly important that you're on the same side. You know, if your starting point for this is, well, good luck, but, you know, I look forward to you going back into a day job. You might as well never bother, because the roller coaster is just too extreme to get there on your own without that backup and support.
Yeah, and look, it's incredibly taxing on the relationship as well, because one's mind is going to naturally be obsessed about how to make the business successful. And you don't leave that when you leave the office. And, you know, that's something that continues to be a struggle. And I think for many founders of organizations, as they're starting to scale the business up, that's a struggle. I guess for me, the biggest catalyst for me to kind of make the move is this concept that there's a professor at INSEAD, Neil Verdon, who talks about management decision making, and he talks about this idea of minimizing future regret. And the concept is, when you're faced with a big decision with a couple of paths, what path would you regret in 10 years' time or 15 years' time not taking? And for me, the way I framed it was, would I rather stay where I was, become a partner at my consulting firm, be successful in that role, which is where I hoped I would end up. I'm not saying that I would, but where I was hoping to end up. Or would I rather start a business that solved this issue of food waste and even fail? Which of those two paths would in 15 years have more regret for me? And when I asked myself that question, I would have regretted staying where I was because I wouldn't have taken that risk. And, you know, I think that helped me to clarify why I was doing what I was doing. It was more important for me to try to take a shot and maybe miss than it was to not take the shot at all. And that was what springboarded me to make the move, and something that I haven't looked back since.
I'm just interested in exploring attitude to failure around the extent to which you're up to your neck in it in terms of, you know, kind of sense of responsibility and ownership of what you're trying to do, versus the degree of detachment and objectivity you're able to take to what it is you're trying to do, and how your approach enables you to deal with the ups and the downs and the setbacks, and, you know, to take a more resilient approach.
Yeah, I really, for better or for worse, take full responsibility for the outcome of the organization, and probably more responsibility than necessarily is attributed to what I could do. At the same time, both emotionally and mentally, I want to leave everything on the field, to use that, you know, metaphor, to be able to make sure that this organization can be successful. And so I want to have spent everything that I possibly can mentally and physically and emotionally to make this business a success. And if it doesn't work out, I don't want to have any regrets that it's been there. And it's that mental attitude that has helped me kind of fight my way out when we've had our backs against a wall from time to time. At the same time, I acknowledge that I'm never going to go hungry. At least I hope not. I have a good education. I have a good background, and I will be employable. I have confidence that regardless of how this venture works out, you know, I'm going to be okay. I think that there's a lot of upside if this venture works out, and I think that there's a lot of investment that I have made mentally, financially, you know, physically and emotionally, to be able to stand it up. And so very much want to see it succeed, but don't have, I have alternatives, and have confidence that I can see my way through that. You know, one of the things that did hold me back from starting a business in my past is self-confidence. And when I fully had that self-confidence and I didn't need to prove anything else to myself professionally, was when I finally decided that I was going to go build a business full-time on my own. I wish I would have had that self-confidence earlier in life, but I didn't.
Well, I think a lot of people would recognize that. It's, you know, all the way, it's self-limiting beliefs, one way or another, that hold people back. I just wondered on that front, you know, where's your head at now, in terms of things that you're conscious you could do better at, and how do you address that?
I'm trying to learn now how to manage a team of 60 people operating in 4 different offices around the world where my direct impact on the business is much smaller than what it was even 12 months ago. And I'm trying to learn how to lead more than how to do. I am trying to learn how to focus more on how do I engineer the organization to be as successful as possible, as opposed to trying to be the person that delivers the result. And that's hard, right? I think any manager goes through that. I think we're also, as an organization, asking ourselves, how do we take this to the next level? And it's exciting that we've gotten a bunch of companies like IKEA, like Costa, the division of Carnival Cruise Lines, like Accor Hotels and others, to set really bold targets to cut food waste and to use our technology to do that. And that's exciting for me because it starts to create a broader movement in the industry. And I think now my appetite's getting a bit bigger, to be able to say, okay, now how do we really accelerate things further? And that appetite comes from a fact that I think this is just fundamentally a problem that needs to be solved. And, it, you know, that's I think kind of that long-term ambition has always been there, right? But we're at a point now where things are starting to turn over, and we're asking ourselves, how do we make them turn over twice as fast?
Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us on Change Hackers.
Thanks, Tony. Great talking to you.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.